in North America communicating with each other about what's going on firsthand on the ground. So that's what the Sunday school class is about. It's kind of a it's a kind of a semi-subversive activity. So social, political, and religious change does not occur throughout history at an even rate. We are today living through a period of exceptional change. So you think about the early 1500s in Europe, so 1517 and up to, we'll take the life of Calvin up to, you know, 1560, 1570. That 50-year period would be a time of rapid political, social, religious change in Europe. And things were different at the end of that 50-year period from the beginning of that 50-year period, and then they sort of crystallized and remained the same for 500 years after. And that was the significance of that period of change. So the historians who study the period of the early Reformation, there are some cheap seats up here that are readily available, and a couple over there as well. So we are living through a period in time when things are changing very, very quickly. And so you can't assume that change will be incremental. You can't assume that it will continue to be this fast, and you can't assume that it will not speed up. One of the things that's happening is that the pace of change since 2000 has increased. 2008 was a major shock to our economy, a major thing. And then 2015 is pointed to by many people as a time when change began to accelerate. And 2020 was another period. It's as if what happened in 2001, even faster change occurred as a result of 2008, the financial crisis, and then even faster change as a result of 2015, 16, even faster change as a result of 2020. And so now we get to 2023, and we don't know if we are just getting started with the acceleration or not. And so we're living in a time of uncertainty, and we need to be like the men of Issachar in the book of Chronicles, who, it says, had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. Understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, and that is our need, our great need today, to understand the times we're living in. What is going on? If you're not panicking, you don't understand what's going on, is something that people sometimes say. So what is going on? Well, let me tell you a little bit about Canada. Canada was founded in 1867 by an act of the British Parliament, and it was founded as a Christian country. The Fathers of Confederation were British in origin. They were Christian. They, even the ones from Quebec who were Roman Catholic, were very strongly Roman Catholic, not like today's Quebec Roman Catholics, who are very secular and materialistic, but they were believers. So the country was formed by basically Anglicans, Catholics, who actually believed in God. Sir Leonard Tilley, for example, was the premier of New Brunswick, one of the four founding provinces in 1867. And he was reading his Bible the night before a key meeting of the Fathers of Confederation. And he was reading Psalm 72, and he came across the verse, "He shall have dominion from sea to sea." And the next day in the meeting, he proposed that the name of the new country, this is what they were discussing, well, what will we call this new country? And he proposed that it be called the Dominion of Canada. And that's the name that it acquired. And so the Dominion of Canada became an independent nation within the Commonwealth. And the head of state is still the Queen or King of England, but the Governor General has a largely symbolic function, and the real power was vested in the Parliament of Canada and the province and the provincial legislatures. There was no constitution, of course, because in the tradition of British common law, the constitution was something that had developed organically over centuries. Usually the starting point is identified as the Magna Carta around 800. And the idea is that that the common law is a gradual, evolutionary, increasing recognition of the natural law and applying it to the positive law of the state. And so Canada, for most of its history, was more conservative than the United States. The reason that, that Confederation actually happened was in large part due to the rabble-rousing down here in the colonies, and the rebellion of I never forget Arthur Holmes of Wheaton College said that when he went to England and studied at Oxford, the professor kept referring to the revolt of the colonies, and he didn't know what they were talking about, and then it dawned on him gradually they were talking about the American Revolution, and so that's kind of a Canadian perspective. The Canadians would have that same kind of a perspective that the loyalists came to Canada who decided not to side with the revolution, and that's where New Brunswick came from, actually, is the United Empire loyalists coming up from the eastern seaboard and settling in New Brunswick, and that's why it separated from Nova Scotia and became its own province. And so our history is to be not really sympathetic to revolt or revolution of any kind, but very, very interested in peace, order, and good government. Those are the catchphrase for Canada is peace, order, and good government, which would be equivalent to the space occupied in the American psyche by the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are two different ways of approaching the world. And I say all that because you need to understand how radically revolutionary some certain recent events in Canada have been. Today in Canada, all political parties are to the left of center. So just let that sink in for a moment. All political parties are to the left of center. I'll mention that yesterday, the Conservative Party of Canada, which you would think would be conservative, is actually a slightly left of center party. Traditionally, there was one left of center, one right of center, conservative and liberal. Liberals were left of center, conservatives right of center. Conservatives were the party of big business, the party of the economy. The liberals were the party of individual rights and liberties, etc. And then, of course, we had the socialists. The NDP was the third party, which sometimes held the balance of power. And so what has happened in the last 15 or 20 years is that the Liberal Party has actually moved to the left of the socialists. And the Conservative Party has been drawn in that direction. Probably the Overton window has moved from what used to be the center to what is now somewhere on the left is the new center. So it is significant that in the lockdown, in the events that I'm about to narrate to you, the Conservative Party was very weak and very unwilling to speak up against the actions of the government. But it is interesting that the party leader was expelled, was stepped down after the election that followed the lockdown situation, and he was replaced by a new leader who is slightly less awful, to be honest. It is interesting that yesterday they passed two resolutions. This will tell you what Canadian politics is like. At the Conservative Party national meeting, they passed two resolutions. Now, these are non-binding on the party leader, okay? But they are expressions of the will of the membership of the party. So a couple thousand Conservatives meeting for their annual convention in Quebec passed a motion saying that that parents should be notified by schools when children are being socially transitioned, gender theory. So that was one. And the other was that we need to, as a party, we need to take a stand against men being in women's only spaces. Now, these positions were considered to be very right-wing, and the the media made sure to emphasize that these positions are not binding on the leader, and the leader was not in favor of them, but this is the new leader who's more conservative, wasn't in favor of them, but he allowed these things to come to the floor, and in the minds of the left-wing media in Canada, this was very concerning that he would allow such radical right-wing things to come to the floor of the convention, even though they were non-binding. That's where we are. However, the polls are showing that about 72% of Canadians favor the parental notification thing, and so they're dancing around. On the one hand, the media will vilify them if they say anything in favor of this, and on the other hand, 72% of parents want it, so it puts the Conservatives in a uncomfortable position. So today, there are no legal restrictions on abortion. There is no law about abortion in Canada at all. Even the Conservative Party refuses to talk about abortion as an issue. Euthanasia was legalized in 2016, and Canada is now already, 5 years later, the most permissive jurisdiction in the world with regard to assisted suicide. California legalized assisted suicide in the same year as Canada did, 2016, and California and Canada have about the same population, about 40 million. And so California in 2022 had 500 and some assisted suicides. And the number in Canada was over 10,000. The number of people who are being killed legally in Canada by MAID, M-A-I-D, Medical Assistance in Dying, it increased from 2.4% of all deaths to 3.3% in 1 year. That's a 35% increase in 1 year from 21 to 22. The Supreme Court imposed this on the country, the Supreme Court has been completely captured by the ideological left. If you follow American politics, if you can imagine, to give you an idea of the Canadian Supreme Court, it would consist of nine Sonia Sotomayors. Okay, that would be the Canadian Supreme Court. When it was imposed, when the Supreme Court ordered Parliament to change the law, because they said that it was not in harmony with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, that the law prohibiting assisted suicide was not in harmony with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms because people have the right to die, the right to have control, sovereignty over their own lives. When that happened, the government did change the law, and the law was changed to say that that assisted suicide was possible in cases where death was immediately foreseeable and the suffering was grievous and irremediable. Now you have to watch those lawyers like a hawk, because the definition of words is very important. Grievous and irremediable does not mean terminal necessarily. It could be terminal or it might not be terminal. Grievous means that it's serious, it affects you. And irremediable means it can't be cured. But you can have a lot of grievous and irremediable conditions that last 40, 50 years. And it doesn't necessarily mean, so it's being interpreted today that you do not necessarily have to be anywhere near the end of your natural life. You can be people in their 30s and 40s. And now, of course, the next thing is that if this was established, then the age is being lowered, and now minors are becoming eligible for assisted suicide. And as of March of 2024, the government intends, it was delayed for a year, but the government intends to make assisted suicide available for anybody with a mental illness. And if you ask me, what is a mental illness? I do not know what a mental illness is. The term is used so vaguely today that it can mean anything from legal insanity to clinical depression. Many of the most vulnerable people in our country today, people who are depressed, people who are lonely, people who are suffering from financial stress, people who are having difficulty, who have conditions, medical conditions that make it difficult to live and who are not getting the help they need. These people are easily victimized through medical assistance in dying. Now, I'll tell you one more story that when I say these things, I'm not even sure if you believe me. Like, you may think I'm crazy, but you can look it up, as they say, on the internet. Veterans, Canadian veterans of the armed forces who have suffered because of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, etc., have been calling the Department of Veterans Affairs and getting caseworkers, asking for help, like wheelchair ramps to get, you know, to get into their houses, or help with various medical conditions. Maybe they don't have any way to pay for counseling for depression, whatever that is they're seeking. And veterans have called the government for help. And in the course of the conversation, they have been asked if they've considered MAID. This has now been established through testimony before a parliamentary committee. So it's not really in doubt that this has happened. And so the result of that was, it was a bit of a scandal, but the media was very gentle on the government, as it usually is. And the minister, Macaulay, has not resigned. No one has been fired. No heads have rolled. He said he was looking into it, and it wasn't department policy. So I guess that makes it all right. If it's not the government policy, then even if it happens, it's okay. But that's the situation. So a study in a journal published by Cambridge Press, a journal devoted to geriatric medicine. An article recently that I wrote about in World talked about the, it went through all of the things that make assisted suicide in Canada, all of the aspects of the policy that make it dangerous and make it much too readily accessible, and came to the conclusion that I came to long ago, which is that Canada, like many advanced industrial countries, faces a crisis in terms of increasing deficits, aging population, most medical care in a socialized system being extended in the last couple of years of life to most people, and as taxes max out and tax revenue can't be increased anymore, the plan seems to be that what we will do to save money and make healthcare not crash completely, because it's, some people think it's crashing already, but it's, you know, it can always get worse. But the idea is that MAID is going to be utilized, so that MAID will become, I think, the major way, the leading cause of death, the major way that people die. People will be angled toward choosing assisted suicide before their medical bills get so expensive that the government is bankrupted by taking care of an aging population. So this is where we are heading, and it's not even, I mean, we may be up, as of March 24, we probably are there in terms of having all the legal mechanisms in place necessary to implement this dystopian vision. In January, February 2022, Canada was shaken to its foundations by social unrest arising out of the COVID lockdowns. The Truckers' Freedom Convoy attracted worldwide media attention and intimidated the federal government into going full fascist and suspending civil liberties, like the right to associate and meet, the right to speak, the right to say things on social media, etc. And our reputation for peace, order, and good government was shattered. And it's amazing how, when you read media from around the world, how the impression the uniform reaction is, oh, surely you can't be talking about Canada. Canada is full of peace-loving, polite, civilized people who just, you know, for years when we travel, the travel agency would advise you to get a little Canadian flag and put it on your suitcase or your lapel as you travel around the world so that people would know you're Canadian, because everybody likes Canadians and they know that Canadians don't cause trouble and this sort of thing. Well, it was interesting watching reactions in the EU, from Eastern Europe, from the UK, from various places, marveling at what is going on in Canada. What is, people began to be good government. As order broke down, peace and good government went out the window very quickly. And what was shocking was how quickly civil liberties went out the window. It wasn't a long drawn out process. It was like overnight, suddenly, you couldn't do what you thought you had the right to do. Now, of course, 2022, we're 2 years into COVID, and the lockdowns have been ferocious. And it's interesting that one of the laws that sparked this was partly the United States' fault too, but both countries were saying that truckers couldn't cross the border without having had the COVID vaccine. And this imperiled the livelihood of most long-haul truckers. Most Canadian truckers do not just drive in Canada, they cross the border all the time. And they're back and forth. And when they were, so these are people who are driving in trucks alone all day. And they are having, they are being forced to take, well, they were the ones who actually, this, they were the ones who spearheaded this revolt. They were the ones who were, because they were literally losing their livelihoods. They were losing their trucks, losing their ability to earn a living. And they were so desperate that they knew, by going to Ottawa and parking their trucks in the streets of Ottawa, they knew that they could very well lose their trucks. And it didn't matter because they were going to lose them anyway. That's how desperate they were. So in January, the Freedom Convoy began in BC, and they started arriving in Ottawa. January 30th, there was a news conference held in Ottawa. February the 4th, the authorities requested towing companies to tow the trucks out of the downtown core of Ottawa, and the towing companies refused. So this was the first sign of more of the protest spreading and public support growing. In February, we had multiple farm tractor convoys arriving in Ottawa. Trucks were beginning to block the Ambassador Bridge, which is one of the main crossings down at Niagara. And there were blockades in Alberta at the border. The border was open, but the protest was there. There were protesters in Quebec City, in Toronto, in Winnipeg, Regina, Calgary, and in Nova Scotia. There was a directive that protesters were not allowed to block or disrupt traffic on any road, street, or highway. I think if you, to be a little bit cynical here, if you had a card that showed that you were a Greenpeace protester, I think you were allowed, but otherwise, no, not allowed. February the 10th, the Ontario Superior Court grants request to freeze accounts. So this is very interesting. The banks immediately rolled over and capitulated to the government. My bank, the TD Bank, was the first to do so. And basically what they're saying is, we want to freeze the bank account of the truckers and their supporters. And of course, supporters can be defined extremely broadly. If you were to sell a propane canister to a trucker on his way to the convoy protest, as a convenience store, you could be construed as supporting and you would be exposed. The Ontario court freezes access to the crowdsourcing fund GoFundMe, and the GoFundMe completely rolled over and capitulated to the government as well. On February 14th, I'm tempted to say, a day that shall live in infamy, which you know what that phrase means. On February 14th, the government of Canada announces the Emergencies Act invocation. And so they invoke the Emergencies Act, which basically suspended the rights that are guaranteed under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And the Emergencies Act was proclaimed on February 15th. At this point, the protest was going on downtown Ottawa. The street in front of Parliament Building was blocked by trucks, and they were not being moved out. And the Children's Aid Society of Ontario issues a statement basically saying, well, you know, if this protest is going to blow up into violence and these people are going to get arrested, they've got their children there with them, I guess we'll have to step in and take care of the children. And so this was obviously an intimidation tactic to scare people into thinking they're about to lose their children. And then on February 17th, banks start to freeze accounts linked to illegal protest activities. So they actually began to freeze. I actually began to think, well, I have spoken out in public as being in favor of the protest. So technically, if I go to the bank tomorrow, will I be able to take out money? My bank account never got frozen, but I don't know if that was because I was too timid in my... You know, there's an old joke about two Lutheran pastors, and one is in jail under the Nazis, and the other one comes to visit him. And he says, oh, Fritz, what are you doing in here? And he says, oh, Hans, what are you doing out there? So I kind of felt like that maybe I was doing something wrong because my bank account wasn't frozen. I mean, we can joke about it, but it's not really funny. At the time, we were actually scared. We were actually thinking that maybe if this keeps up, like Trudeau imposed this act, and there was no end date to it. Like it was going to go on and on. And I won't get into all the technicalities; it won't take too much time. But the law says that the cabinet is the one that proclaims the Emergencies Act, okay, puts it into effect. But then the act of the cabinet has to be ratified by the parliament within so many days. And it has to be ratified by the House of Commons. And as soon as the NDP, we have a minority government in Canada, so the Liberals are a minority supported by the NDP, the Conservatives are the official opposition. So as soon as the NDP announced that it was supporting the Liberal government in this act, then you knew that the House of Commons was going to vote in favor of it, and indeed it did. By the way, at this point in the debate in the House of Commons, usually the debates in the House of Commons are utterly boring and no one pays attention, but we were actually watching them online at this point. And the Conservatives began to show some signs of going against the government. All through COVID, the Conservative opposition had been totally passive, just letting the government do anything it wanted to do. And now some fight was beginning to show. The leader was totally passive, however, and he was soon out, and a new leader was elected that was part of the fallout after this. But the House of Commons was going to clearly vote for it, and it did. But the Senate also, that old relic, that old bunch of old geezers in the upper house who supposedly have no power at all in our system, technically the Senate had to approve it as well by a certain deadline, or it would be null and void. And the Senate is made up of a whole number of, they're all political appointees by the Prime Minister. That's where they come from. That's how they get to be in the Senate. And it's sort of like the British House of Lords. But the debate in the Senate was actually the one place, not the media, not the House of Commons, not any other place in Canadian society, but it was actually the Senate of all places, where there was the most ferocious debate about the propriety of this action by the government. And so the debate went on for several days. And by Friday, there was going to be a vote. So on a Wednesday and Thursday, and senator after senator got up. And the trend was that about 50-50 were for and against the government's action. And many, because the liberals have been in power for more time than the conservatives have over the last 20 years, most of the senators were liberal or liberal appointees. But of those senators, a good number of them were opposing the liberal government. So this was getting to be, this was making Trudeau more and more nervous as Wednesday went into Thursday, went into Friday morning, because it was beginning to look like the Senate might just vote against the government by a narrow margin, which would mean that the whole imposition of the Emergency Act and the debanking and the and all of the things that were being done would be illegal and would have to stop immediately. And it would be hugely embarrassing for the government if this were to happen. So the debate was scheduled, the vote was scheduled, I think, for a Friday afternoon. And the on Friday morning, Mirabile Dictu, the Prime Minister, calls a news conference and announces that that the Emergencies Act is going to be revoked because it's no longer necessary. So there were, never was a vote in the Senate, so we don't know if they would have voted against it, but I suspect that given the circumstances, it must be the case that they were desperately afraid that the vote would go against the government, which meant that they quit before they could be fired, and they stopped it. So on February 23rd, the Prime Minister revokes the Emergencies Act. Between February 14th and February 23rd, we seriously were feeling like very vulnerable, really feeling like, where is this going? Like this, we're not in, like before February 14th, it was one thing. And after that, it was another, and we were feeling as though we just didn't know where this was going. Liberal democracy seemed to be hanging by a thread in Canada at that point, at that moment. And I don't know, you know, people on the left like to argue about the definitions of words like Marxist and socialist and fascist and communist and all these and progressive and all these words, and they have 95 arguments as to why nobody ever fits the exact definition, and you can't really call so-and-so one of those words, and so on, all that. When you actually come right down to it, in a modern society, when liberal democracy isn't even the best system of government in the history of the world, theoretically, but when it is hanging by a thread, you feel as though it's like things that have taken centuries and centuries to slowly build are in danger of being wiped out in a moment of time. You begin to realize that things are much more precarious than they ever thought that they were. So what is Canada today? Canada is a multicultural, bilingual, pacifist, globalist, materialist country with no awareness of its history, no sense of nationhood, and nothing to hold it together except federal handouts. Literally. I mean, that's the way our confederation has evolved. So things like health care are the responsibility of the provinces. But the taxing authority lies primarily with the federal government. Provinces can tax, but the federal government has chosen to tax the population at a very high rate. So what they do is they take in this tax money from all over the country. Then they redistribute it back to the provinces for health care and other things with the goal of ensuring uniformity of standards across the country so that the poor regions of the country have as good a health care as the rich regions of the country, the populated regions. That's the theory behind it. But the unintended consequence is that it means that the federal government becomes completely in control of almost everything. And the situation now is that if you have the federal government, the media, and the large corporations such as the banks cooperating together to enforce uniformity of thought and to squelch dissent. Maybe that's not fascism in the classical definition, according to political scientists, but it walks like fascism and it talks like fascism and it quacks like fascism. And even if it isn't fascism, it's still very bad, and I don't want it. You know, that is the way, you know, even if you can prove to me that it's not technically fascist and Mussolini did something different, I don't care. Well, whatever it is, we are finding it to be dangerous and bad. So how do we, this causes us to ask questions about how do we live in a society like this? How do we as Christians interact with our culture as culture changes in these ways? And so I want to share a few thoughts about that with you. Okay, so in 2022, February 2022, very interestingly, just as the whole crisis in Canada was unfolding, Aaron Wren published an article in First Things magazine called The Three Worlds of Evangelicalism. And in this article, which you can find online, and he's now got a book coming out about the same ideas, he says that, that you can divide recent history into three phases. And so pre-1994 was positive world, neutral world was from 1994 to 2014, and then negative world from 2014 to the present. So in positive world, society, and this is primarily an American, but it applies, I think, equally to Canada, society at large retains a mostly positive view of Christianity. So if you want to fool the rubes into voting for you, you go to church, even if you haven't been to church in years, because church-going people are generally regarded by the population as better people than non-church-going people. That's positive world. Being publicly Christian is a status enhancer. Christian moral norms are the basic moral norms, and violating them bring negative consequences. Okay, that's positive world. A neutral world is where society takes a neutral stance. And so Christianity is neither privileged nor disfavored. It's being publicly known as a Christian is irrelevant. It doesn't have a positive or negative impact on one's status. Christianity is a valid option within the pluralistic public square. This was the atmosphere in which First Things was founded. It was an attempt to bring Christian viewpoints into the public square. And so the assumption in neutral world is that the public square is open to Christian arguments and viewpoints. But negative world is different. In negative world, society has come to have a negative view of Christianity. Being known as a Christian is a social negative, particularly in the elite domains of society. Christian morality is expressly repudiated and seen as a threat to the public good. Subscribing to Christian moral views or violating the moral secular order brings serious consequences. So Rand is arguing that we have moved from a positive to a negative world. This is an analysis. You can poke holes in it. You can argue about the dates and all that sort of thing. But it is true. I think the central insight that is being identified here is that modern secularism was never a permanent condition for society to inhabit. That modern secularism was always a halfway house to something else. It was always about a way of pushing Christianity out, but not just to have an empty public square, but in preparation for something else coming in to fill the void eventually. And that, I think, is the central insight that Wren has identified. By the way, just as an aside, for those of you that were there Thursday night, we talked about the book Abolition of Man. Well, Michael Ward, in his book about A Guide to the Abolition of Man, he mentions that A.J. Eyre was one of the big philosophers that was influential in Oxford when C.S. Lewis was coming of age. And A.J. Eyre is famous for writing Language, Truth, and Logic, which is a book about logical positivism. And it argues that every statement in the world is either a tautology, it's either saying the same thing twice, Or it is a statement about something that can be empirically verifiable. And if it's not one of those two things, it's meaningless. It absolutely means nothing. And anyway, Lewis was against this, of course, and this was part of the background to Abolition of Man. But Ward, in a footnote, mentioned something very interesting, that years and years later, like in the 40s, an elderly A.J. Ayer was being interviewed, and he was being asked about what is left in because Lewis and others totally punctured the argument. They said, so Ayer is saying, no sentence is meaningful unless it's either a tautology or empirically verifiable. And Lewis would say, so the statement, nothing is meaningful except that which is a tautology and empirically verifiable, which category does that statement fall into? Is it a tautology or is it empirically verifiable? And of course, it's neither, which means that the whole argument is bunk. And so Ayer was being asked about, what remains of your book, Language, Truth, and Logic, and the logical positivist philosophy that you put forward? What remains of it now, decades later? And Ayer's answer is very illuminating. He says that basically not much. He admits that the whole principle has fallen apart. But he said it was still valuable to do because it was a way of clearing out the debris from the previous Victorian era and getting rid of the beliefs and the moral standards that had existed at the time. And it was a way of sort of putting those aside so that we could get on with searching for something better. That's very illuminating. And it speaks to the whole philosophy of secularism, the whole idea of we should have a secular society, so we should get religion out of the schools, out of the courts, out of here, out of there. Why is that being done? Not so that society can remain empty at its core and have no moral beliefs, but so that the way can be prepared for something else to take over. I think that Wren's article is pointing to the fact that something else is coming. And that's what we need to be thinking about as Christians. What is it that is taking over the public square in our day, in our situation, in our culture? What is replacing Christianity as the core set of beliefs that affect that are on the basis of which our society is built? How do we put this in perspective? Just in closing, let me just say quickly, one thing that we need to understand is that the center of world Christianity is shifting from east, from the Europe and North America to the global south. So if you look at the Anglican Communion, Canterbury is becoming marginal now. Canterbury is becoming a not very influential center. The center of world Anglicanism is in Nigeria and Tanzania and Kenya, not in England. This is not the first time this has happened. So the center of Christianity at one time was the Middle East and the Mediterranean basin, and then it moved to Europe, and then it moved from Europe to North America, and is now moving from North America to someplace in the global south, probably Africa. So it's happened before in history, and it's happening now. We should be aware of that. Secondly, the decline in Christian influence is due to two factors: the decreasing number of active Christians in a given society and declining confidence in the truth of the Christian faith. And so the way to have more Christian influence in society is to plant more churches, do more evangelism, and to disciple people into a stronger, confident belief in what we believe as Christians. And that is how we will have influence. And one of the biggest challenges in the coming year will be divisions among Christians. I just want to say, though, in the last 2 minutes, I read a little brief summary of three different attitudes toward Christianity and culture that you should be bearing in mind. So in a pre-Christian culture, the strategy is occupation. The strategy is to enter, as Christians, to enter into different parts of the society, different little centers of influence, and Christianize them as best as possible. So live out your life and your vocation as a Christian. In Christendom, the strategy is to advance. The strategy is to enter into politics and to change the society increasingly in the direction of a more moral and more Christian society. But in a post-Christendom situation, the strategy can be strategic retreat. And that is to maintain our witness without compromise and to do whatever it takes to make that possible. And if maintaining our witness without compromise means retreating from certain areas so as to strengthen other areas, to find a sphere of influence in which we can allow the Christian faith to dominate, then we need to do that in whatever way, that whether that's geographic or whether that's in part of the class system or whether that's Christian schools or whether that's whatever it is, that needs to be our strategy. So I would just throw that out. I was hoping to be finished a few minutes earlier to have question and answer, but I guess we don't really have time, so I'm going to turn it back to Jim. Yes. All right. Let's bow in prayer. Father, we do thank you for the fact that, as Isaiah teaches us, you are the sovereign Lord of history and in control of the rise and fall of nations, and that in your providence nothing happens, but that you allow it to happen, anticipate it, and work it into the fabric of the totality of reality in such a way that good comes of everything. We have no idea from our limited little creaturely perspective how you're going to bring good out of our day, out of our situation. But we just pray that you would help us to be as faithful and loyal to you as possible. Help us to dedicate ourselves to reading your word and following your word and believing, and then help us to trust you with those results. Lord, we ask this now in Jesus' name.
Amen.